Session 9, Helping Your Child Stay Drug-Free. Not all kids fall prey to alcohol and drug use. In this session, Betty and Brian will share with you how to safeguard your child from drug and alcohol use, and what to do if you suspect your child is using.
In the last session, we've been talking about how to raise high achievers, Brian, and it seems appropriate that we discuss what certainly is a deterrent to that, and that's drug use with our young people.
Yes, I think it's probably the major single concern on the minds of parents today is, are their kids going to take drugs? Are their kids taking drugs? Are drugs going to affect their performance later on in life? This is really an important thing for us to talk about.
It really is. Brian, I find that parents are pretty much divided into two camps. They either just don't believe that their child is going to participate in drugs. They see themselves as successful. They see themselves as coping without drugs, and they just believe that that's going to be true for their children. And when children do use drugs, they're just in shock and disbelief, and they spend a lot of time in denial. Or the other camp is they believe that drugs are just a phase of childhood, and both camps can be very serious. And I think that's really what the framework of this session is about, and that is helping parents not be so frightened by drugs, but in fact to know that they have a very responsible role in ensuring that the child won't say yes to drugs, won't use drugs, and in fact that they give their child some options for saying yes to alternatives to drugs.
Right. Well, one of the things we have found is that parents have a tendency, as you say, to practice denial. They don't want to know. If they suspect it, they don't really want to be confirmed in it. They don't want to believe that their children could be taking drugs because in a way it reflects upon them as parents. They feel, I must have failed my children if my children, after everything I've given them, are now using abusive substances. And it's amazing how times have changed in the last few years. When I was growing up, something like 4% of young people in the 50s had experimented with drugs. Today, it's something like 57% of young people have experimented with drugs by the time they get into high school. Parents Magazine had an interesting little article called Changing Times recently, and it compared the major non-scholastic problems that public school students reported during the 40s and during the 80s. And let me give them to you. The number one non-scholastic problem that children had in the 40s was talking in class. The number one in the 80s is drug abuse and drug addiction. The number two was chewing gum in the 1940s. The number two in the 80s was alcohol abuse. The number three in the 1940s was making noise. Number three in the 1980s was pregnancy. Number four in the 1940s was running in the halls. Number four in the 1980s was suicide. Number five in the 1940s was getting out of turn in line. Number five in the 1980s was rape. Number six in the 1940s was wearing improper clothing, if you can imagine. Number six in the 1980s was robbery. And number seven non-scholastic problem in the 1940s was not putting paper in wastebaskets. Mm-hmm. Number seven in the 1980s, believe it or not, was assault in the school. Times have really changed.
They have, Brian. You know, if you read that 1940s list alone, you know, the talking, the chewing gum, the not putting the waste paper in the waste paper can. It's almost cute. And if you read the 1980 list alone and in single file, it's just downright scary. You know, I taught school for a number of years, and I am very involved in the school place now as a consultant, and I see these problems day by day in the schools, and the schools are dealing with them in a major way. What is new is that these problems used to be a part of just certain children, a drug culture, so to speak.
The losers, the what they call the druggies and the no-hopers.
Right, and I think that's the real fear in today's times is that, Brian, your children and my children could also be a part of that culture because drugs are so pervasive, they are so easy to get. And the fear for parents everywhere today is that the whole drug milieu has changed. Not only are they more available, they are less expensive. The drugs today are stronger. A marijuana joint in the 1960s is much different than a marijuana joint today. I mean, just the whole cloud that is around the drug use for our children is much more serious. There's much more involved today than before, and that's a fear for parents.
And isn't it true that marijuana is the number one cash crop in the United States today? $60 billion a year of marijuana is being raised and sold, and no matter how much they interdict or apprehend, even more of it's being made available?
It is, Brian, but you know, drugs for children fall into a couple of different camps. Younger children, and we're talking now, Brian, about children as early as third and fourth and fifth grade participating in using drugs. We used to think of drugs as a college problem in my day, and then, of course, it became a high school problem, and then it became a junior high problem. And now schools across the country are looking at really intervening in third and fourth grade because drug use is very prevalent.
Yes, and Betty, one of the things that we really have to emphasize in this program is that more and more children from excellent homes with parents who have excellent values and who go to church and work hard and pay their bills and tell the truth and spend a lot of time with their kids, what they perceive to be a lot of time, kids from excellent homes who on the outside are doing well in school, getting good grades, are scoring well in sports teams, are very popular and likable, that these children, in many cases, are just as likely to be using drugs as what we used to think of as just the losers or the outsiders in school.
That's right, Brian. I just recently did a two-hour television show with a young man by the name of Craig Fraser who has a book out called Burnt, and it's about his story of getting involved in drugs and his road to recovery. And he was a popular student council president. He was on the honor roll. He was a gifted athlete. He was a model child in the home place, you know, and his parents, and he had a close relationship with one another. And yet he became a part of the drug scene. And I think that is something we need to talk about, and that is what drugs are. Because young people define drugs into soft drugs and hard drugs. So a soft drug might be something like wine, or it might be a diet pill, whereas a hard drug might be cocaine or heroin. And so children have different perceptions about the safety of drugs.
The question is, why would children start taking drugs in the first place? The first reason that parents get is, well, it's probably peer pressure. Their peers are imposing it upon them. And yes, that's true, but that's only a symptom. The reasons that seem to be coming out in the research is that children get into drugs because, first of all, they feel an enhanced feeling of efficacy. They feel more competent. They feel smarter. They feel more alert. If they're taking drugs or uppers or something like that, sometimes they perform better in athletics. They seem to have better senses of humor. They seem to be more popular. In other words, the real needs that children perceive that they have are to be more effective, to be more likable, to be more successful. Going right back to what we talked about earlier, performance-based self-esteem, children are taking drugs because in many cases they feel it enhances their performance, makes them more competent, and therefore makes them more respected and popular.
I think that that's really true at the high school level. I think at the elementary level and even at the middle school level, the primary reason for drug use is that it is seen by children as a rite of passage. They see a television ad that says you'll be more popular if, or you know, you'll be more sociable if. They see their parents taking a glass of wine or a cigarette. They see adults using drugs, and the acceptability of drugs seems to be associated with growing up. And so for small children, it is a rite of passage. And therefore, when we talk with parents about helping children say no to drugs and find alternatives to say yes to other things, we talk about helping them get an appropriate image about drug use. In the high school place, though, Brian, and for older children, 8th grade, 9th grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, even college kids, we do look at not only availability of drugs and the peer pressure, but also for performance, and that's an important one. In schools, I do a lot of assemblies for youth, and one of the things we look at is how they can perform and excel without using drugs. Many youngsters do use 2 and 3 diet pills a day in order to stay up. And then, of course, because they burn up that energy, they crash. And so now they're looking for another drug to stay up or to pump out more performance. Children give one another very mixed messages about how you can stay up and perform and excel with drug use. And I think because that's so true, you and I have to say to our listeners that they have an important role in helping their children look at performance and being up and being on, and to do that in a natural way. I'm sure you have conversations with your children about sleeping and nutrition and all the kinds of things that keep the body ready for performance and peak performance. My daughter, who is 16, is an outstanding athlete, and she's always looking for ways to get one more ounce of energy, one more ounce of stamina to be up and on for the final the next day or to pump out a term paper after an incredible day of school and athletics. And I have taken her to a health food store to help her look at the ingredients to keep the body up and on beyond sleep and that kind of thing. And those are important measures that we do as parents and help our children. What we're saying is, I understand that you're wanting to perform and that you're trying to feel at your best and that you're trying to excel and that just normal rest and nutrition aren't cutting your schedule. I think it sends a message to children. Here is a better and a healthy way to cope.
I think one of the things that parents listening to this would be really concerned about is, What do you do? How can you create a family structure that enables your children to be more resistant to drugs, to be more resistant to peer pressure? And again, I'd like to quote from Parents Magazine, because there's some wonderful instructions that have been very well thought out by child psychologists. And here are some of the guidelines. First of all, is if you want your children to respect what you say, learn more than they know about alcohol and drugs. It's amazing how many children think that their parents really don't know about alcohol and drugs, so therefore what right do they have to tell them not to use them? I think another thing about alcohol and drugs, especially alcohol, is the research seems to indicate that children's first introduction to abusive substances is by imitating the substances their parents take. So if their parents drink at home on a regular basis, the children's first introduction was they will drink at home too, or drink privately.
Right. You know, Brian, they say that 50% of all of the drugs that children have, they actually get from the home place. Alcohol is a very big one.
And nicotine is another. They'll start smoking if their parents smoke. They'll start popping diet pills if their parents take diet pills. It's the old saying, the old thing about don't do as I do as I say, but the fact is that children learn by imitation, so they're going to do what you do.
We call that gateway modeling, where if a parent takes an aspirin every time a headache is there, or if they take a drug or something to calm everything that they have going on, then a child learns that you can make all these things go away via a drug.
Or if they come home at night and they say, boy, I've had a rough day, I need a drink.
Right.
Or what I think is even worse is the influence of television, where whenever anyone is under stress, they say, I've got to have a drink, or they rush over to the bar and pour themselves a big stiff one and throw it down, as though that is the normal adult response to stress and difficulty, which, of course, it isn't or it shouldn't be. The second guideline for teaching your children about drugs is if you want to protect your children, give them very clear messages about how you feel about alcohol, about drugs, about sex, and so on. If your children have no idea about what you believe, or if they receive mixed messages, they will be confused and therefore more vulnerable than necessary. Again, it comes back to giving them very, very clear guidelines. Children are inordinately influenced by the strong beliefs of their parents. And many young people say that they develop the courage and the ability to resist the influence of their peers by blaming it on their parents. They want their parents to be the bad guys, but in a way they want their parents to protect them by them being able to say, well, my parents are so straight, I couldn't touch that because they'd really be down on me. And other kids recognize that kids don't want their parents down on them, so sometimes kids can use the fact that their parents are very clear on the subject to put off their peers about taking drugs or experimenting with them.
We're really saying here to parents to be very careful about looking at the attitudes that you give out. An adult might say, oh, come on, have another drink, or oh, come on, have one for the road. These are all modelings that kids pick up on.
Yes. The third guideline is if you want to minimize conflict, have clear rules and clear consequences if those rules are disobeyed. In other words, your children, especially your teenagers, should know that if they do A, they're going to get B. And then the next guideline is if your rules are ignored, make very, very sure that the logical consequences follow every single time. If you say that if you do this, you're going to be grounded, if you do this, you're going to lose telephone or car privileges, and the children do it, then follow through with it every single time. Because young people are not only very expedient, but they're very, very quick at picking up whether or not you're serious. It's that cattle pasture theory of child raising. They've got to know that the fence is secure all the way around before they can follow your guidance.
That's true, Brian.
All right, the next guideline that I would think is important for parents is if you want to make your rules stick, join with the parents of your kids' friends, at least on the phone, to check with them and to make sure that what you're demanding of your children is consistent with what is fair and what's going on, if you like, in the marketplace.
Brian, that's really important because so many parents trust their children. And while that's an important one, they do need to follow up. Who are you staying with? Where are you going? Oftentimes, if parents will really look closely, children, and especially children who are using drugs already, may not be following through on that. So follow through and find out where your children are going. Check with the other parent if your child is staying overnight. And if your children are meeting at your house and staying at your house, make sure that an adult is home.
Sometimes kids will try to buffalo their parents by saying, well, so-and-so's parents let him do this, and so-and-so's parents let them do that, so therefore you're being unfair. And parents don't want to be accused of being unfair. So what we do in our family is we say, oh, is that true? Well, I'll just phone so-and-so's parents right now. Let's go and call them, and we'll ask them, and then I'll be clear. And almost in every case, my children say, no, never mind. I was just kidding. that wasn't what their parents allow. So keeping in touch with other parents allows you to know what the market is doing with regard to child raising.
Yes, the other one that's real close to that, Brian, is to not only know that the other parent is there for a support system, but to set a timeline for children being in. We find that children, when they go to activities, it's not the activity so much where they get into trouble. It's the hour or two following. And many parents set much too loose of a guideline on when their children should be in, that curfew. And so a curfew is a very important thing. And check with the other parent. I always call the other parent and say, I want my child to be in by 11 or by 11:30. Is that what you follow too? Or I'm going to ask your child to be in by 11 or 11:32 because that's the guideline for my child. And invariably the other parent says, oh, thank goodness, somebody else cares.
Yes. Another guideline in this article says, if your children are closely tied to a peer group, remember that you still have influence. Teenagers need parents and other adults as guides through the minefields of moral development. If your children are running with an inappropriate group, try to identify and encourage their other friendships. Try to get them to invite the children that you like home for dinner or over for the weekend or for sleepovers. Try to get your children more involved with the better young people and move them away by the law of the excluded alternative from a negative peer group that may influence them inappropriately.
That's right, Brian. The real key is bringing children home. There are a couple of other things we can do, Brian, and that is we need to help our children learn how to assert their feelings, their independence. We have to help children learn assertiveness. Children need to be able to say, no, I don't want to drink, or no, I'm not going to do marijuana. Now, that's an important skill because in the face of another child standing there, they often become intimidated and they lose face and they don't want to do that. And so they'll participate even though they might not want to. And so if you can teach your children how to communicate assertively, a child is more likely to say, no. And that's an important part of being able to save face and to leave.
A very helpful technique that parents can teach their children when the subject of drugs is discussed, and you can say, you know, in general, you're going to have experiences where people are going to offer you drugs at school. And if you don't want to take them, you don't have to say no. All you have to do is say, not right now. There's an old saying that delay is the cruelest form of denial. But the fact is that you can delay endlessly without saying no and without getting into conflict or having to defend your actions. You can say, no, I've got a test coming up, or no, I have to go home right after school, or no, I'm going to be in a sports event after school, so I can't do it now. So you just delay, and you continually delay. Eventually, the people who are offering your children the substances will go off and offer them to others who are far more receptive. Betty, I wanted to ask you, how do you tell, what are the symptoms that a child is on drugs? You're very experienced in this area.
Well, the first that we look for, Brian, is personality changes. If your child is normally easygoing or joking or fairly quiet, if all of a sudden you notice great personality changes, and that change has been going on for a couple of weeks now, that's the first cue. The second cue is that your child changes his appearance, because in order to move over to the group that's using drugs, he has to fit into a new culture. And so you'll see a new costume change.
So in other words, they will almost like a bird acclimatizing to a new habitat. They'll start to change their feathers, if you like. They'll start to dress a little differently. They'll start to wear their makeup if it's a girl. They'll start to wear their hair differently if it's a boy.
Jewelry is a real big indication because usually children in groups will have specific codes of dress. And jewelry is a big one. Earrings, for example, or the color black and that kind of thing. But that doesn't mean to say that your child is not using drugs because of that. I mean, if he's using diet pills or doing marijuana, or it's unlikely he's going to do a major wardrobe change. But if you do see changes in clothing, you'll also see some changes in friends. You'll see changes in eating habits. You'll see changes in study habits. Those are some of the real key. Some real crucial ones, too, is to watch your liquor supply very closely. I know that that sounds fairly dramatic, but children will oftentimes take from the liquor stock that you might have, and many parents don't monitor that. And oftentimes they'll add water to the liquor if they're drinking. And it's not until 5 or 6 or 7 months later that parents realize that a great change in the liquor supply has been occurring. And liquor is often a gateway drug into the other harder drugs. Or children will use alcohol as a way to combat some of the other drugs going on if they don't want to do drugs at home, but then alcohol becomes that drug of choice at home.
What the research is suggesting, as we said earlier, is that parents often engage in denial. They see that things are changing. They see perhaps the liquor supply has gone down. They see their children's habits and attitudes and social circle is changing. but they sort of pretend that it's not happening because they don't want to deal with the complexities of it. The other thing is that parents, if they will spend, and again this recommendation comes over and over again, not just a couple of hours a week, but absolutely 10 uninterrupted solid minutes per day with each child, they will have the ability in many cases to head off problems at the pass, because those 10 uninterrupted minutes will start to keep the lines of communication open. They'll start to make them more sensitive to if the child is changing, and they'll give the child or the teenager an opportunity to talk and to express his or her concerns that may be leading to the attraction to drugs.
There's no doubt that when children feel there's a closing off of that important need for the love that flows between a parent and child, there's no doubt about it that when that closes off, a child will turn to a peer group. We look at the fact, Brian, that a good percentage of children who become pregnant say, we say, what's going on? Why the pregnancy when there are so many alternatives? What was going on here? And children say, I just wanted somebody to love, and this is my person to love. There's no doubt about it that in those cases, so often the child is not feeling loved or being a part of the parent's most primary circle. And the same is true with drugs. But that doesn't mean that all drugs are a part of that. Many children get into drugs, and then because the body is so easily influenced by drugs. I mean, when you look at dealing with a child once they're on drugs, one of the reasons we say to parents, don't get hostile and don't punish your child, know that you're now dealing with another mindset. Your child's mindset is altered. He's using drugs. And so we say to parents, don't keep your head in the sand. If your child is using drugs, don't just try to talk him out of it. Get help.
So basically, the first advice we would give is that if you suspect that your child is on drugs because you see behavioral changes or dress changes, first of all, don't get angry. Don't get hostile. Don't get defensive. You've got to approach this very sensitively for two reasons. If you make the child defensive, the child will back away from you, and your ability to influence the child positively, or the teenager for that matter, is going to diminish. But second of all, you can't really argue, counsel, debate, guide a child that's on drugs.
No.
If the child is on drugs, not only are they extremely cunning at masking it, but they will tell you what you want to hear. They will say what you want to say. They will do what you want to do. But in reality, they're not listening to you. So what you have to do is you have to back off and realize that this is not a one-shot problem, big lecture, punishment, send to your bedroom, grounding, and the problem is cured. That if your child is on drugs, you need to begin a process, a systematic and determined and serious process to find out what's going on and then to make a plan to help your child get off drugs.
Yes, Brian, we may want to talk about that for a minute because it's very serious. The first thing that parents should do if they suspect that their child is on drugs is to not necessarily confront the child, but to go right ahead and intervene and get help. In today's times, drug rehab centers abound. It's very easy for a parent to simply take the child and end up at a doctor's office and do a blood test to find out, to do drug testing, to see if, in fact, there are chemicals in the child's bloodstream. That's the first step available to all parents.
And one step in tandem with that is to go to the school, talk to the school counselor, talk to the school nurse, because there's help available for parents that's free, it's of no charge, it's professional, these people are skilled on it, they take courses in it. So you have the slightest suspicion, get in touch with the school and go and see a professional and ask the professional, what's the course of action here in this community with my child in this school? What do you suggest I do to make an intervention?
And I would say, too, that don't wait for the schools to inform you. So oftentimes when I work with parent groups, they say, you know, the school called me and they're suspecting that my child is using drugs. And then perhaps they do some drug testing and they find out that the child has been on drugs for 2 years or more. And they say, why didn't the schools notice this? Why didn't the schools inform me? And it's not the school's responsibility to know, you know, what each and every child is doing in his personal life. I mean, it's almost impossible. And it comes back down to our problem. But I would say to parents that all the research shows, and all of the young people who have talked openly about drug use, and people who have worked and counseled youth on drugs for years and years, tell us this, and this is very frightening. They say, if you suspect your child is on drugs, chances are he's been on drugs for 2 years or more. And Greg Fraser makes this point very clear in his book, and that is that you can cope for a long time and cope very well. He talks about how he became an excellent student and a great athlete via drugs. And so just because your child is doing drugs doesn't mean that his performance is going to fall off in a very negative way. Now, as Greg points out, his changed dramatically. It went up. And then, of course, when the drugs took their toll on the body, it went dramatically down. But the point is, you and I as parents can't wait until we are notified, either because the child is now debilitated or because a number of people in the child's setting has found out that his behavior is changing. We have to know.
And you've talked about how many parents are instructed when they get counseling to pick up the child to go on a shopping trip, and what they'll actually do is they'll drive them casually to a detoxification center and check them in, where they're literally locked in for 2, 3, 4, 5 days, and their blood is tested and their urine is tested, and they have no opportunity either to get more drugs or to change their lifestyle. And only then can you tell not only the seriousness of the drug addiction, but how long the children have been on it and what drugs they're on.
That's correct, Brian. It takes a very caring and a very loving parent to do that. You know, we call it tough love, because it's one of the hardest things you will ever do is to take the trip with your child to detox his system.
The mistake that many parents make is they believe that if their child is on drugs, the child is doing this to hurt them. The child is doing this, and it is a reflection on them and their quality as parents. And they feel that their self-esteem is assaulted, the parent's self-esteem. What the parent has to realize is this is the child's problem, and that as a guide, as a counselor, as a loving parent, it is your job now to help your child solve this problem. And that, as they say, don't get angry, get results. Don't get angry, get effective. Slow down, become calm. Realize that what you have is a major crisis on your hands, and it's going to take you a while to help your child through this crisis. And if you don't, you must be apprised of the statistic that 80% of children that attempt to get off of drugs are back on them again within 6 months. So this is not a one-shot thing. It's going to require, in many cases, a complete lifestyle change, a complete attitudinal change on the part of the parent to help the child get through this mess and on to the other side where they can go on into a constructive lifestyle.
Right. Well, you know, Brian, the study of addiction has really clarified this more and more for parents, and has helped us see that it's not something we should take personally, although it's certainly something we need to be very responsible about. But we're seeing alcoholism more and more in the light of a disease, as an illness and so on, and likewise drug use. If you've got a child on drugs, know that that child is sick and needing your help. Treat it like a disease. You need to seek counseling for that child. And more than counseling, you need to get very active. I'm asked to serve on a lot of counseling boards. And one of the reasons why I really look closely at those boards is to see that the ingredients for helping the child thoroughly are there. You can't counsel anyone out of drugs. It's a very sound program in nutrition, lifestyle change, empowerment, self-esteem rebuilding. It takes a lot of physical activity to recode the genes that have been now rearranged with drug use.
Tell me about that physical activity.
In the 60s, we used to take children who were from dysfunctional homes or children who were delinquents. We used to take them on experiences that we called outward bound experiences. We took them up into the mountains and did hiking and camping, experiences that were very physical, where the kids had a chance to get the adrenaline flowing and get the endorphins working, and a chance to live apart from the culture that they had established. And we found that that was one of the best ways to get youngsters back in touch with themselves, to get some esteem building going on, where they could see themselves as powerful, I can people again, where they could get new hopes for going forward. And the same is true for a child on drugs. You can't just sit there and counsel the child off drugs. You have to recode these genes.
And the discovery is that the only drug rehabilitation programs that work for young people are programs that involve vigorous physical activity. If there is no vigorous physical activity or athletics, the chances of them going back onto drugs are almost 100%. Isn't that correct?
Well, yes, that's true, Brian. And it can't just be a physical exercise program. We're talking about a program that's very comprehensive. And again, the nutrition, the physical activity, the empowerment. helping the child learn to put together his support group, the people who are those people who really love and care about me. One of the things that children find when they get drug-free is that the group that they belong to aren't there as support for them. That's one of the reasons why it's so hard for a child when he goes back, because those kids want that child back on drugs. It's the only way they can relate to him. And you have to rebuild his ability to feel competent and powerful and purposeful. And those are the things that contribute a child to saying yes to something else, yes to a career, yes to college, or yes to school, or yes to something purposeful. Children have to have a reason for being. You know, Brian, earlier in this program we talked about esteem and what it meant, and one of the important components was feeling purposeful, feeling like there was something in your life that was worth doing. And many children who use drugs don't see that. They've lost that sense of purpose. Well, what is life about? I don't know. So you have to help children feel purposeful again, find something that is of purpose and substance to them.
So we could really say that there's three major components to keep children off of drugs or to get them off and keep them off. And the first is the child must feel totally loved and supported and encouraged by his or her parents. The parents have to create an environment of physical and emotional love and affection and security and support where the child feels really great about themselves. They don't feel alienated or detached from their parents. And the second factor is the child has to be feeling that they're doing reasonably well at school. The child has to have a feeling of competence and efficacy, which may involve tutoring, it may involve helping the child with their homework, it may involve even putting them in a different school or a magnet school or a specialized school. But the child has to feel on a day-to-day basis that I'm good at something. Because if the child doesn't have that feeling of efficacy, their self-esteem declines and they look for a source from outside. And the third point that you're talking about is so terribly important for adults as well as young people, is the child has to have a desirable future to look forward to. The child has to have an ideal of what the child wants to be. And the more parents can focus the child on what you can be and what you can do and what your life is going to consist of, and you'll travel and you'll go to a good school or you'll have a good job and a nice car, you'll have nice friends and children and so on, the more the child can associate their current behaviors as affecting their future ideal life or their desired life, the easier it is for the child to do the things today that will assure that that tomorrow comes about.
That's true, Brian. I mean, those three hallmarks are very important. What I would say to parents, and I work with parents, as you know, all the time, sometimes parents have, many parents are very successful in their work. And if we get really wrapped up in our own world, and we think our children feel loved, or we've provided a nice home and a nice lifestyle, and they're in excellent schools, sometimes we make the mistake of thinking that children appreciate all of that or that they feel our love. And an important part is to provide those things for children, but also to help children feel that love and to help them feel that there are goals to go forward to is an important part. So help children set goals so that they feel purposeful and they're working towards something.
And I think perhaps one last point we could mention here that is as important as many other things is the value of the parent being a role model. And if the parent is really concerned that they are setting a bad example, like they come home at night and they immediately have a drink, or they come home at night and light up a cigarette, perhaps the parent is going to have to make the sacrifice of making substantial changes in lifestyle. Perhaps stopping drinking or smoking in the home or diminishing it, perhaps making sure that liquor is not a front and center part of lifestyle activities. Perhaps the parent is also going to have to, instead of talking or lecturing to the child, get more involved with the child, do things with the child. The parent's maybe going to have to give up bowling and fishing and a couple of other extracurricular activities and start playing, living, working, enjoying time with the child that is healthy and uplifting, that gives the child a very strong sense of identity and a positive role model to identify with.
Right. Well, and I wouldn't call those a sacrifice. I would say, as we've been saying all along, it's never too late to be a good parent. And if you suspect that your child is picking up habits that are going to not serve him well, that are going to be debilitating to him, that are going to lead him into drug or substance use, this is a good time to change your own lifestyle, to evaluate what you want from life and what you really want for your child, what you want to teach your child through your own lifestyle modeling, Brian.
And for a parent, never to forget that your primary job is to nurture your children, to raise them with high self-esteem, and have them leave the nest as fully functioning, self-confident, healthy, happy adults capable of taking on the world and making a wonderful life for themselves. And any price you pay to achieve that goal or objective will bring you rewards and benefits for all the days of your life.
Session 10, Raising High Energy Children. Your child's energy level, performance at work and play, even his behavior, is largely based on his nutrition, a basic and vital ingredient. Learn what you can do to ensure your child is properly fueled.
Ernest Hemingway once said that something moral is something that you feel good after, and something immoral is something that you feel bad after. And what I found in raising children is that diet and food and the things they put in their mouths almost fall into those two categories. For instance, not long ago, Christina, who is 9 years old, came home from school and she was acting erratic and she was fighting with a little brother. And then when we tried to discipline her, she would shout at us and she was running around. And finally, she just burst into tears. And I took her and I hugged her and I said, "What's the matter, honey?" And she said, "Well, she went over to her friend's house and, Daddy, I ate too much sugar. And I really feel awful." And the fact is that children are very, very expedient, and they put into their mouth whatever tastes the very best at this moment. But in many cases, what they put in their mouths is very, very bad for them and can become a habit. So in this session, I think we should talk about how to raise healthy, high-energy children and give a whole bunch of ideas that parents can use to raise children and to train children to eat the right foods.
And there really is a very close correlation, as you've been saying, Brian, about between nutrition and children's behavior. You know, in the schools, we found out that 70% of all children come to school without breakfast in the morning, and the brain is a very chemically sensitive organ, and it's very difficult to get children to do any learning when that brain has not been fueled. But likewise, the other children who have breakfast oftentimes have a very high-sugar cereal breakfast in the morning, and teachers find it next to impossible to work with those children. Also,
you know, the critical issue really is energy. It's the critical issue for adults. It's the critical issue for teenagers. It's the critical issue for children, is how much and how long we have a sustained flow of energy during the day. And it's impossible, of course, to have energy unless you've been properly fueled from the very beginning. So why don't we sort of base this whole session on what parents can do to help their children have those high levels of consistent energy that enable them to do well in school, that enable them to feel good about themselves, that enable them to, if you like, have a much more diminished need for any kind of abusive substance that might be characterized as an upper or as an energy giver. Let's talk about some of the keys to health and to high levels of energy.
Brian, the first one would be proper weight, to maintain a proper weight. Research shows that most all of us have a proper weight and that we are more likely to have a high energy if we stay within that frame.
Yes, lots of the research seems to show, and parents can benefit from this too, is that there's a new body of knowledge called under-eating without undernourishment, which means that you run lean and mean. If you eat and you keep your weight just slightly under your ideal weight. And what they find is that if you eat foods that have higher levels of nutrients, more nutrient-rich foods, you can eat less of them, and you'll have just energy to burn all day. And I think that parents really have to be the role models. Parents really have to take on the responsibility of exemplifying for their children what a person with proper weight, proper health, proper diet looks like.
I agree, Brian. I think that modeling is a very powerful one. I know I even include it for schools. I sometimes look very closely at what my daughter's teachers look like. It's a very powerful image.
Well, you know that we say here over and over again that if you want to know what a woman will look like when she grows older, look at her mother. Or if you want to look what a man will look like when he grows older, look at his father. So parents do set a role model, and not only that, they program their children subconsciously so that even later on in life, their children will have a tendency to take on the physical shape, size, weight, and perhaps eating habits of the parents. So even if the parents don't want to lose weight for their own sake, it's a very good idea that they lose weight for the sake of their children and perhaps even their children's children.
I agree. Brian, and the second one would be a proper diet.
And that's where we should focus, on proper diet, because there is a lot of nonsense and half-truths that are spread generously about what is a proper diet and what is not. And I'd like to start off this session talking about the research into the diets of the athletes at the Los Angeles Olympics. They took and they looked at the diets of athletes from 120 countries to find out what were the high-performance diets. And they brought foods from all over the world, so they had their own diets to eat. And they found that there were three things they all had in common. The first was what they called lean source protein. Lean source protein. In other words, they got their protein from lean meats, from fish, from whole grain products, from lean or non-fat dairy products. Lean source protein, and it represented less than 15% of their total diet. The second ingredient, and perhaps as important as anything else in the high-performance diet of Olympic athletes, was fiber-based carbohydrates. Fiber-based carbohydrates were defined as predominantly fruits, vegetables, and whole grain products. Non-fiber-based carbohydrates, or sources of sugar, are, of course, candies, milkshakes, chocolate, things like that that have no fiber, but just simply are a source of sugar. And the third ingredient of a high-performance diet, interestingly enough, is lots of water, that the top athletes to perform at their very best with maximum levels of energy consumed 6 to 8 large glasses of water a day and even more when they were training.
Brian, let's talk about what that really means in the home place, because you and I are parents and we know that our youngsters spend a lot of time at school and that a lot of times what they eat is not in our control. And I think that's an important part for parents. We've been told that 50% of the parents leave home in the morning before children are up and dressed and off to school. So it might mean that many children in America have breakfast on their own, lunch on their own, or at least, you know, away at school. And, of course, many children get home from school before parents get home from work. I know that I try to monitor my daughter's breakfast in the morning. And sometimes I do a good job of that, and sometimes I don't. Sometimes she's not in the mood for breakfast, or she wants to eat something on the way to the car or to school. And at lunch, I can monitor that only to the degree that I know what the school is serving. What I do find important is that I can control what she eats when she comes home from school because she's starving and she will eat anything that is there. And so I know that her next agenda after school is homework, her evening chores. You know, she has to get that energy level back up. And oftentimes after a full day of sitting and then some athletic activities after school, she's beat. And so I find that if I prepare in the morning before I leave something for her to have after school, that I can count on the fact that that will be consumed. You might talk about how you ensure your children to have nutrition, Brian.
Well, one of the things we do is we are actively involved in our children's breakfast. Is our children are now learning how to make their own, but when they make their own, we have trained them so that it has to be a high-protein breakfast. It has to be whole grain cereals, it has to be scrambled eggs, it has to be toast, it has to be orange juice, it has to be fruit. Because the research shows that if you do not eat a high-protein breakfast, it's the equivalent of throwing gasoline on a fire. You get a big flare-up of energy from a sugar breakfast, but by 11 o'clock in the morning, your energy levels nosedive, and children become tired, they become inattentive, they become unable to concentrate. Even adults who do not eat high-protein breakfasts nosedive by 11 o'clock in the morning. The natural tendency for adults, however, is they then have a coffee break where they eat a chocolate bar or a donut and a cup of coffee or a Coke, and they get an energy surge, and it rushes up, and inside the body, the pancreas goes into red alert because of all the sugar in the bloodstream and rushes insulin into the bloodstream in an oversupply to suck out all the extra sugar. So a person taking a sugar coffee break, if you like, has a rapid rise and then suddenly a nosedive where they crash again. And if they do what most normal people do, they take another sugar break, and so their energy level goes up and crash all day. Most children are eating the same way, unfortunately, because of the way they start their day, because of the way they're fed at school, the kind of foods that are made available to them at school.
Right. Well, I think this whole concept of teaching children about how their body operates and about how they get surges and from what foods and how they feel, how it affects them, is a very important link to helping children self-monitor what they eat. I know that when I taught my daughter the rush that she would get from the caffeine in soft drinks, but then how it left her tired. And right after I taught her that principle, she was out riding her horse, and there was no water on the farm that they could drink that day. And so she consumed several Cokes from the Coke machine. And she had incredible headaches that evening and the next day as her body was coming down from this caffeine. And she was able to link those headaches and then the tiredness that she experienced the next day. Now, what she learned from that was actually the effects of those drugs, caffeine, in her system. But this is a very important thing that we do teach our children, how foods affect our body.
Well, we've heard over and over again that you become what you eat, that you are what you eat. And there's an enormous amount of information that suggests that many of the problems that we have with children, their attitudes, their behaviors, their sleeplessness, their ability to study and concentrate, their personality, their behavior, a lot of these things can be traced back not to emotional difficulties, but merely to nutritional difficulties. Isn't that true?
It is true. You know, Brian, criminologists who have largely ignored the biochemical influence of criminal behavior nutrition have rethought that link. And a number of centers in the states have looked at juvenile delinquency, looked at those youngsters. And one of the first things they're doing now is looking at their chemical balance, their chemical imbalance, and looking at the overall nutritional patterns. And there is a very strong link between the nutrition and juvenile delinquency or delinquent behaviors in young people.
You mean what you're saying is that certain foods consumed on a regular basis can actually contribute to major behavioral problems that lead to juvenile delinquency?
Absolutely.
Well, you have a list of them there, don't you? Let's tell the parents that are listening just what the foods are that are most harmful to children.
It comes down to the cookies, the donuts, the flavored yogurt, the breakfast cereals, commercially made granola is one of them. Anything that's processed or packaged foods, canned foods are particularly harmful. Sugar, white bread, white flour are particular no's. Fruit-flavored drinks.
There are three poisons that we talk about in our seminars all the time. We call them the three white poisons that everybody should avoid eating. And let me explain what they are. They're, first of all, white flour. Second of all, white sugar and white sugar derivative products. And third of all, salt, or if you like, white salt. And let me talk about white flour for a second. There's enormous amount of research that shows that when the diets of the Western peoples, the Western civilization, was primarily based on wheat and whole grains, that their levels of health were quite high and that their levels of degenerative diseases were quite low. What has happened, though, is that since the introduction of white refined flour and products made from white refined or bleached flour have predominated in our eating habits, the level of degenerative diseases has gone up absolutely dramatically by hundreds and hundreds of percent. And the reason for this is that white flour products are inert. In other words, they are dead products. In order to make the flour white, they have to bleach it. In bleaching it, they kill all the nutrients in it. Having killed the nutrients, they then often put in artificial nutrients and they call it enriched white flour or enriched white bread, which they then put in an oven at an inordinate temperature and cook and bake and burn out all the nutrients. So when you eat a piece of bread or a roll that is made from white flour, you are getting a food substance that has zero food value at all. The only food value is what you put on the bread, but there's no food value in the bread at all.
You know, Brian, the study of orthomolecular psychiatry is largely the study of the nutrition and the effects of what's going on in the bloodstream on the mind and behavior. And we see counselors now over and over, if they're dealing with a child who is a behavioral problem, they'll start looking at what's going on in the system. What is the child consuming? What kind of balance, what kind of nutritional balance do we have here? And that's a good thing to know because you and I as parents and parents everywhere are dealing with children's behavior. Even in the school place, we see that the behavioral problems are on an increase. I mean, it's not just, as you were looking at earlier, not picking up your paper or chewing gum. We're talking about children whose behavior is very, very destructive. And to know that we can offset behavior or affect behavior by what a child eats is a link and something we can do something about.
Right. And the second white substance that is a poison is sugar. Any kind of white sugar product. The reason why is the average American, average Canadian consumes between 160 and 180 pounds of sugar per year. The average American or Canadian needs none. In fact, there is enough of complex carbohydrates which break down to sugar in the body from fruit, from vegetables, from pastas, from sauces, even from meat and from other whole grain products, that in reality people don't need any sugar. They don't need sugar on things. They don't need sugar in things. And one of the things that you can do that dramatically increases your health and energy, causes you to feel better, reduces your level of tooth decay, is to start to gradually eliminate sugar products from your diet and from the diet of your children, and replace them with naturally sweetened products, especially fruit. Probably the very best thing you can train your children to do is to eat lots and lots of fruit.
And when you take sugar away, it's not very long before your children simply don't miss it.
That's right. The children do not know that sugar is not good for them, and they get into the habit of it. They look for the fastest, sweetest thing. But if you train them to have fruit instead of desserts, very soon they accept that training and they naturally reach for the fruit. Now, the parent's job is to understand that most children eat impulsively. Therefore, they will reach for whatever is there. And the parent's job is to make sure that what is there is good for them rather than not good for them.
And that it serves them, that it's a kind of an eat to win, and we can teach children that concept.
And the third white poison is salt. The average American or Canadian consumes 20 pounds of salt per year. The average American or Canadian requires less than 2. Almost all foods have salt in them, and as you said, the list that you just read, canned foods, are inordinately high in salt. And the reason for that is that in order to preserve the shelf life of a canned food product, they found many years ago the best way to stop it from going bad was to kill it before you put it in the can. So most foods, especially soups that are canned for use later, have been killed with massive amounts of salt. In fact, if you read the ingredients on the can or on a fast food product or soup or something like that, you'll often find that there is more salt than water. There is more salt than there is the foodstuff that is in the can or in the package. And if you just take the salt shaker off the table, take it away, and do not add extra salt to foods, you'll find that people are healthier. Children have more energy. They tend to be thinner because their bodies don't retain water. They tend to have a tendency to sleep better. Excess salt is harmful to children in a whole variety of ways.
In raising high-energy children, we've been talking about proper weight and a proper diet. And another area is enough exercise. We call it adequate exercise, but exercise for children.
Yes, exercise is so important for three reasons. One is that if children exercise adequately, of course, they release endorphins in the brain. This gives them a sense of well-being. They feel positive about themselves. They feel happy. In many cases, they feel elated when they engage in vigorous physical exercise. We know that adults, in order to be physically fit, need to exercise vigorously for 20 to 30 minutes three times a week. Children need to do it the same. Also, they need the exercise in order to work off a lot of excess energy that they build up. And of course, the best kind of exercise is aerobic. And the reason for that is that when children get a lot of aerobic exercise, they get a lot of highly oxygenated blood to the brain. Not only does it enable them to concentrate better, not only do they think more clearly, not only are they more creative and more personable, but aerobic exercise assures that they sleep better at night and that they have more energy for their classes in the daytime.
You know, a lot of parents think that children get more exercise than they really do. We cart our children to school, we take them to school, we take them home. They sit 5 and 6 hours a day. And in many schools around the nation, we have done away with recesses, physical activities, health book education, textbook courses have taken the place of a lot of these courses. And so children are not getting the exercise. And we see a lot of children who are not physically fit. And so the aerobic exercise that we've been told, you know, the cardiovascular exercise 3 times a week, 20 minutes in duration, is not so much a part of our young people's lives, and it's really showing up. And so as parents, we can be sure, whether your child is skateboarding in the street or bicycle riding, that physical activity is a part of his schedule.
And that goes right back to what we talked about earlier, is encouraging our children. If our child expresses an interest in soccer or swimming or dancing or gymnastics or ballet, to encourage the child by saying that's a great idea and taking them to the course and going and watching them when they perform. Children just love to have their parents watch them when they perform. And what happens is that once a child gets into a sport or into an activity, they develop what is called a positive addiction, is that the actual playing of the activity makes them feel so good that it positively reinforces them and intensifies their desire to do more and more of it. But it's the parent's job at the beginning to encourage them and to support them and to go and see them and watch them and talk about their sport and praise them and at how well they're doing. With my little girl who takes gymnastics, she was a little bit reluctant at first. She wasn't sure if she wanted to go or not. So we went with her several times. And then I went and I took photographs of her doing her initial gymnastics exercise and went and I got them developed. And I gave them to her and we handed them around our family. She took them to school to show her friends. Do you think she's locked into gymnastics now? She can hardly wait to go to gymnastics. And she's not even aware of the conditioning process that went on that caused her to feel that this is something she really wants to do.
And besides being such an integral part of good health, this really is an area where parents and children can develop some closeness, Brian. I know I've taken up tennis as a way to have togetherness time with my daughter and also to show her that physical fitness is an important part of my high energy at work, my high energy of life after work, and also a time for talking and for just being together. So again, we're talking about the importance of high energy when you're working or playing, but also it's one of those times where parents and children can be together, and I think that's a real challenge of parenting today.
Yes, and it's interesting. They say the family that plays together stays together. This wonderful movie called Field of Dreams is all based around a grown man's desire as a son to play catch with his father. And the whole movie revolves around that and finally concludes with his father, if you like, coming back from beyond the grave and the two of them just playing catch, is playing a sport together. And I know that boys really, really need to have their fathers interested and involved in their sports. And even if they don't play the sports physically, they need to know that they want to come and watch and they want to be on the sidelines. And I know that girls need a lot of encouragement and want to know that their parents are really interested in their athletic activities. So I think that one of the kindest things you can do for your children is to constantly encourage and praise and reinforce them. And remember, it's not whether they win. It's not even whether they do it especially well. The fact is that they just do it and that they enjoy it. And the primary part of a child's enjoying athletic activities are the emotional ramifications and support that they get from their parents in those activities.
Sorry, I'm reminded of a study that said that girls who say that their father is their favorite role model in the family, they say that primarily because they associate playing a sport with him, playing catch or tennis or something that where there was a playtime together and it centered around a sport.
Oh, that's wonderful.
As a mother, that was important to me because I said to myself, wait a minute here, if that's an important link, that being together but skill development, I said, I want that time with my daughter too.
And it has to do also with self-esteem, because a child feels valued and a child feels good about himself or herself to the degree to which their parent spends time with them. And it doesn't even matter what you're doing or how well you're doing it. It is the fact of the time that is so important. But if you can kill two birds with one stone, if you can encourage your children to engage or begin engaging in a lifetime of physical fitness, a lifetime of physical activity, by associating physical activity with a loving relationship with a parent, then you're doing your child a great kindness that will benefit them for many years.
I agree. Brian, I want to say just one other thing here, and that is that I want parents to catch the link between exercise and energy. I discovered when my daughter was in second grade that she would come home, and that was at that time she was identified as in gifted classes, and so she had an inordinate amount of homework to do. And I discovered that she would come home from school and want to just have downtime. She was exhausted. And I needed to find creative ways to bring that back up. And so I would just do a bicycle ride with her and it would bring her energy back up. And I noticed over the years that if she would do exercise, a 20-minute, whether it would be a bike ride or whether we'd go outside and kick soccer balls or whatever it was, if I could get her active in sports again, I could bring that learning curve back up. I could bring her energy level up. And that's an important link because schoolwork is oftentimes left to an evening when children are mostly down. And speaking of down, since we've been talking about sports and bringing children up to high energy, I think we need to talk about that downtime, Brian. And that is proper rest, right? Just as important as being up the exercise, it's important to help our children have downtime, rest.
Yes, and many times children don't realize that what they need more than anything else is to go to sleep. Every parent has wrestled with their children, trying to get their children to go to bed on time, and the children don't want to go to bed, and the children get up. And sometimes the children break out in tears because they're so tired. And sometimes what they need more than anything else is for the parent to insist that they go to bed early. And you've been doing some reading or some research on how much sleep children actually need?
Well, when I wrote the book, Helping Your Teenager, A Parent's Guide to the Adolescent Years, we looked at the importance of rest because so many teenagers burn out. The burnout in the adolescent population is very, very large, Brian. Kids who just give up, say, I've had enough. And so we looked at nutrition and wellness and rest and so on. And Stanford Research Center says that teenagers, actually there are several ages of children, children between the ages of 2 and 3, children between the ages of 7 and 9, and children between the ages of 11 and 14 need from 10 to 12 hours of sleep nightly.
Because they're going through growth surges?
Because of what's going on internal, their internal need and demand for growth. They say if you want to watch a child's natural need for sleep, watch him on a day where he has no pressures, a Saturday or Sunday, and he'll wake up at 9 or 10 or 11 or noon. And that's because the body is naturally absorbing that need for rest.
And so the solution, of course, is to turn off that darn television. Probably one of the major reasons why children stay up too late is because they sit up watching television till 10 or 11 o'clock. Sometimes what we've found is that if you watch a particularly violent or active movie, the child will not be able to sleep because they're so impressionable. Their minds will churn with pictures and images, and they'll have insomnia that will last them 2 or 3 hours. And in the morning, they're exhausted.
I coach parents in two areas when it comes to rest, Brian. And the first is to set a regular bedtime. And that means even if your child has a term paper or extra homework, bedtime means that that's about it. You know, you can fudge on it a little bit here and there, but basically the mind goes down and it's you're just kind of spinning your wheels. So a constant and consistent bedtime is really useful to children. The second thing is to help children once they get to bed, take the mind and bring it to closure. The goal is to get some rest so that the next day you can manage your day. And we use a tape that's a relaxation tape, and it says to children, and we programmed it for elementary children and for high school children, and it says, okay, you've had a good day and some great things have happened and some not so good things have happened. And then we, you know, get the mind focusing on those good things. So the child starts bringing into play those positive images. And then we say, and now let's take a look at, you know, the day tomorrow, when we start programming the child forward. And then soft music comes on. And pretty soon the child is moving into a whole state of relaxation. If you take a child, whether that child is 4 or 5 or 2 or 7 or even 15 with bad habits, you can bring the child to around to the point where they are actually expecting the body to come to a stage of peace and rest and then close it down for sleep.
And here's another good point, is that you cannot just announce to children at 9 o'clock, go to bed. At any age, what you have to do is you have to have a one-hour wind-down period. You have to announce if you want your children to go to bed at 9 o'clock. At 8 o'clock, you begin the wind-down. You say, okay, now it's time to start getting ready to go to bed. If you start at 9 o'clock, children resist rapid change of any kind at all. But if you say at 8 o'clock, at 8:15, at 8:30, now it's time to get ready, now it's time to brush our teeth, now it's time to put on our pajamas, and so on. And, of course, the older the children get, the later is the bedtime. And the second part, is as important as anything else, is the discussion or the talking or the tucking in that you do with your children. With young children, you kiss them goodnight and hug them and talk to them and tell them how much you love them and that they're going to have a good day tomorrow. Sometimes with older children, it's a good idea to talk to them in these terms, to have them tell you what was the best thing that happened to them today. So the last thing that they go to bed with was the memory of a discussion of the best part of their day, not their frustrating part, but their very best part. And I have found that even for adults, if you're having difficulty sleeping, if you'll just turn your mind and think about something good that happened to you today, think about something positive, think about a lesson you learned, think about something that was uplifting. As you think about that, it acts like a natural sedative, and your mind tends to go calm and relax, and you find yourself just falling off to sleep. And training your children to do the same thing, too, is very helpful to them.
And if you're talking about preteens and adolescents, music is a very powerful image here. I ask parents to help children understand that last hour, we do not play heavy metal music or acid music, hard rock. We put on something that's more gentle. And again, you're teaching the child to start tuning into the softening of relaxing the body and moving it into a stage of sleep.
So in a way, what you're saying is that last part of the day is a family time, too. It's a time where you talk, where you mutually unwind, where you start all preparing to move to bed, maybe at your different staggered bedtime hours. but it's not a time where the family atomizes and goes off in all different directions. Is that it's a time where sort of the family's coming together as they move toward sleep. And, of course, there are a couple of other things that we really should put into this tape on what children can do or what we can be aware of that are conducive to high energy.
And another would be no smoking, Brian.
Oh, yes. Smoking is associated with, 32 degenerative diseases, everything from arterial sclerosis to lung cancer.
And it's also a gateway drug. Smoking leads to marijuana to the others. It looks fairly harmless, but it is considered the biggest gateway drug.
Maybe we could even end this session with a recommendation that many, many happy families have found, and that's the importance of the family dinner hour. It is the importance of making the family dinner hour almost a sacrosanct part of the day. Many fathers, many mothers, many families have found that by shuffling their schedules and by being very disciplined about it, they can assure that at least at dinner, the whole family sits down together peacefully and happily.
The overall goal, Brian, would be to teach children the cohesiveness of the family unit, the peacefulness and the bonding and the unity that children find there. Children's days, just like our days, have ups and downs. And we want some place in their life to be just a stable, loving, sound environment. We've been talking about the importance of having children have some place in their life where they can count on, where they can trust, where you're there for them. And the family dinner table is oftentimes that uniting factor.
It's like an anchor.
It is an anchor.
What we do in our family is each of our children has a job that's associated with dinner. And each child either sets the table or clears the table afterwards or takes the food to the table or gets our little guy set up for dinner. And then when we all sit down, we have a ritual. And the ritual, as we're going through the dinner, each person is asked to tell us what their high point of the day was, what their low point of the day was, and what the funniest thing that happened to them was, so that each child gets a chance to fully express the high and low points, the salient points, if you like, of their day. And then we each comment, or we laugh, or we joke, or we give them feedback, and then we go around the table. And that acts as a tremendous conversation starter. So the conversation just keeps going around and around all the time we're at dinner, but it always starts off with the high points of each person's day.
I think playfulness best represents our dinner. It's the time where we laugh and talk and joke, and just you can see the playfulness of our family best at dinner time. And it's a place that everyone looks forward to.
And it's so important that there be no anger, there be no criticism, there be no recrimination, there be no scolding at the family dinner table. All of those things should be very carefully excluded from the dinner table. The dinner table must be seen as a place of peace and happiness and togetherness, and put any criticism or discipline or, if you like, constructive feedback in another place at another time.
These are really important principles for raising high-energy children, and I think that's a real goal.
So basically the keys are make sure that your children have excellent nutrition, make sure they have a good breakfast, make sure there's lots of fruits and high-quality foods available, make sure the family eats together, make sure your children get lots of sleep, and really just constantly give some thought to the physical activities, what is going into the child's body and what is happening to the child's body on a day-to-day basis is a fundamental part of raising them as happy, healthy, self-confident young people.